So maybe I was thinking the best thing to do is to kind of frame out what genomics is first, just for people who don't quite know, and what sequencing is, like in a really like simplistic way, just for the people who might not exactly know what sequencing a genome is.
So this term has changed quite radically in the last 20 years as all these new sequencing tools have emerged. But sequencing is effectively reading the letters of life of A, T, C, and G, the letters that write DNA in our genetic code. And sequencing today can include sequencing DNA or sequencing RNA. The reason that's important is DNA is kind of like the copy of your hard drive in your cell. But RNA is really like your task manager, which programs are getting run currently. So when you sequence your RNA, you can get a sense of what the cell's instructing itself to do through DNA. When you sequence the DNA, you get a catalog of everything it could potentially run. So we've been using these tools to better understand what's in these vaccines because we assumed that they were only RNA, which is a code that goes into your body and instructs your cells to make a spike protein. As we've dug deeper into this, we've found out that there's more than RNA in there. There's in fact a lot of DNA in there as well, and that may have some repercussions. But to circle back to your initial question, genomics is just a study of being able to read and write genetic code. It's predominantly right now reading it because we're much better at reading the genetic code via sequencing than we are at writing it. We can write really small fragments and sentences. We can read entire genomes. So we're log scales apart in our capacity to read and write DNA in the genomics field.
Wow, that's such a cool thing. I never even thought of it that way. Like, when you learn a new language, for example, you can learn to read it, write it, speak it, right? And I tend to be really more competent, I guess, with reading first and very bad at writing. And I never thought, hey, that translates into genomics.
It does. It entirely does. I mean, there are some tools emerging that are really exciting right now that can use enzymes to synthesize DNA. We typically have been doing it using a chemical process called Carruthers synthesis for the probably last 30 years. But it's very slow, caustic, and expensive. Hopefully the enzymatic approaches really catch the writing side of this back up to the reading side of it. But yeah, we have sequencers that can read trillions of bases at a time. We can maybe write thousands of bases at a time with some of the synthesizers. So they're really, really far apart right now in terms of the capacity I think the largest genome that's ever been written is a 2 meg genome of Mycoplasma genitalia from Ham Smith. And that's the record. But we've sequenced genomes that are billions of bases in size and runs that do trillions of bases of sequencing. So they're very different tools right now, unfortunately.
Wow, we could do another show on that. I want to pick your brain later, but not now. I mean, the reason why this is interesting to about 6 billion people is because is that you sequenced the mRNA products from both the Moderna and the Pfizer manufacturers. And I heard a little clip of an interview you did with someone else, and it wasn't that you set out to do this, is that right? It kind of it serendipitously fell upon you, is that right?
That's right. I've been curious about this problem for probably more than 2 years, asking people, where can I find data about this online? And there really isn't much out there other than what Andy Fire's lab put out, but there was no raw sequence data. There was just a consensus sequence published. So we do a lot of RNA sequencing in the cannabis field. We were trying to sort out what's going on with hop latent viroid infections in the cannabis field, and we were having some trouble in that process. And I needed some RNA controls to sort out why my libraries weren't behaving correctly. So somebody sent me these, thinking of this is the perfect control. They're polyadenylated. They're 4 kb long. They should have 5' caps on them. They should be pure. So try this, and if you get this to work, you'll sort out your RNA sequencing problems. And they were right about that. It actually did sort out our problems. But what we discovered in the process is that they weren't pure RNA. They actually had a lot of DNA in the background. So yeah, this was an accident that occurred due to our curiosity in trying to solve a pathogen that's devastating the cannabis industry right now.
It's so fascinating because I mean, so many of the most amazing discoveries in science kind of happen on side, like penicillin, right? So it's,
yeah,
it's,
this is not what we were looking for. I mean, we, honestly, my curiosity wasn't about looking for DNA. It was, I have this hunch that the new, the modified nucleotide they have in the RNA may have a higher error rate, and therefore we would see more mistakes in the mRNA. And so I knew that, all right, we have to sequence these like a millionfold deep, like redundantly over and over again to find these mistakes. When we did that, all this DNA popped up. And like, oh, that's a bigger problem. We have to focus on that now. So it was complete happenstance that this showed up. But once it did, I kind of went into a panic mode, realizing that I didn't budget any time to do that and look into this, and the world had to know about it, and I couldn't bury the data. So I had to quickly publish this somehow. You're familiar with what the publication system's like during the pandemic. It's politicized. So I'm like, that's probably not going to get the word out very quickly. I'll have to do my best to document this all in Substack and just put all the data public. And with transparency, hopefully people will come to understand that the data is real.
I think it's really important that it's, you know, that people who are, I mean, there's a lot of naysayers. There are a lot of people with different motives. There are a lot of people who are incentivized. There are a lot of people who are afraid, who simply don't want to believe that there's a possibility that there's, for example, contamination in these products that they've been injected with. So I think it's important for people to understand from your point of view that this isn't something that you're like seeking. It's not something you set out to do. It's something that you discovered through discovery, and you want to and need to share this with the science community. And of course, you know, the way that you and I are communicating most of the time now, what we're finding is through non-peer-reviewed method, you know, modalities like Substack, because, I mean, we should talk about that at the end too, if we have time, like alternatives to peer review, for example. But nonetheless, I think that's an important point to make. So let's get into the nitty gritty. Like, what did you find, and why is it shocking? Because to me, it's shocking. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. You broke up a little bit there, but I think the question was, what did we find? And
why is it shocking?
I think why it was shocking is that I didn't expect to find Pfizer's entire blueprint for how they manufactured this thing sitting in their vial. That to me is a lot of information want me to have.
Yeah. Tell people why that's shocking, though. Tell them why, because I think most people probably wouldn't understand why it shouldn't be there in the first place.
Yeah, so the way they manufacture these mRNAs is they use a piece of DNA to Xerox the RNA off of. Oftentimes that DNA is very proprietary. They don't want people to know all the tricks they put in the DNA to help drive maximum amounts of Xeroxing, if you will. And when we sequenced this, what popped out was their entire expression vector, which shows us everything that they're doing to try to drive the expression of this RNA. So we know that they have a T7 promoter. We know they have an SV40 promoter in there. We know that they have a bacterial origin of replication. And we know they have an antibiotic resistance gene and a couple other features. So the entire map is spelled out letter for letter, the entire genetic code of the expression vector they're using. So what's an expression vector? Well, it's in order for you to get lots of DNA, because you need like grams to kilograms of this amount of DNA to get that the amount of RNA you want out of it, you need to amplify that DNA. So you can either do chemical synthesis, as we mentioned before, in this reading and writing process, which is expensive and error prone, or you can make a piece of DNA that codes for your RNA in a circle known as a plasmid, put it into E. coli, and grow the E. coli up in a huge vat, almost like you're fermenting beer. Okay, so when you do that, the bacteria double every 20 minutes, and you can get exponential amplification of your DNA. Then you have a gobs of DNA, but you have to purify it out of the E. coli, and then you run this reaction on it called a T7 in vitro transcription reaction that just copies RNA off that DNA. So the important thing is this vector that goes into plasmids and goes into E. coli and comes out of E. coli, that is the blueprint for how they make this RNA. And all of that was on full display once we sequenced the vaccines. We could see every component of their expression construct. We don't know what that means clinically, but it really shouldn't be there. There's limitations on how much double-stranded DNA can be in products like this. And they're well above it by orders of magnitude from our measurements.
Right. So that's another important point. So The European Medical Association, I think that's what EMA stands for. they have these limits to which you can have a certain amount of double-stranded DNA in any manufactured product. And those limits are there for a reason. But something that I noticed from your report is that we don't really know how those limits are defined. It's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because I think this is also important, because I mean, when you think about it, maybe no double-stranded DNA should be in there. So do you have any insights on how they determine these limits? And if you exceed what this limit is, what might the repercussions be? I mean, we don't know what's going to happen in the human setting. That's another thing that we should talk about after. But I mean, we have rules and regulations and you know, good manufacturing practices in order for very good reasons, especially when you're talking about this kind of design. I'm just talking a bit longer because I heard there's a jackhammer in your background. So is it over?
it's almost over. I'm debating on moving. I feel like they put it right above my head. Pfizer must have hired this guy to jackhammer right yeah. now.
That's her Pfizer. Yeah.
So the limits are an important question. I don't know how they derive them. I know that they're set at 330 nanograms per milligram. That's DNA to RNA. Now, I suspect that they were concerned of having double-stranded DNA that might be from E. coli, because when you grow this plasmid in E. coli, you're going to get some of the E. coli genomic DNA coming through. They probably weren't considering the fact that the DNA could be amplifiable DNA. Plasmid DNA is unique in that it has an origin of replication. If you stick it in bacteria, it will copy itself to several hundred copies in every cell. So they probably weren't anticipating amplifiable DNA being in their mixture. And so that spec is probably arguably, you know, not stringent enough based on what we're finding. They really need to reconsider what that should be. Now, where I think that limit came from is from a lot of the gene therapy documentation. If you look at the FDA, they have some limits on the DNA should be less than 200 bases in size, and it should be less than 10 nanograms. I think the reason they want low amounts of this is they know if you inject double-stranded DNA, you can get a type 1 interferon response. And there's an increased right. risk of this potentially like integrating to the genome.
Oops. Great. Yeah, exactly. And I wrote a couple of questions. I'm trying to find it now. Related to this, that I know that people are wondering about. So in your very first report, you wrote contamination of double-stranded DNA in these vaccines is a significant concern, which it is. And the EMA specified DS. Double-stranded DNA limits in the vaccines below 330 picograms per milligram. So what was my question? Why do they have limits? Okay, we did that. And actually, I think I wanted to, what's the problem, let's say, with the lipopolysaccharide, which is an endotoxin, like yes. in the context of E. coli, like using that as the system to grow up your...
that's a really good point. Typically, the biggest concern you have of pulling plasma DNA out of E. coli is it comes along with some endotoxin, which is part of the lipopolysaccharide that sits on the outside of the gram-negative cell wall of the bacteria. That mm-hmm. stuff, if you inject it into humans, can create anaphylaxis.
Where have I heard that before, Kevin?
I don't know. Is there a database that might have some information about that?
I think there might be. And I think they might also report sepsis. Is that another yes. thing that can happen?
Yeah, sepsis seems to happen quite a bit as well. Now, I don't have any evidence that there's living bacteria that could be causing sepsis right. In these things. But the endotoxins alone are probably not a good thing to be injecting into people. There's really strict limits on endotoxins. Now there is some documentation, the EMA, suggesting they test for endotoxins, but I don't know whether I can believe the results, because they clearly are astray of their spec on the double-stranded DNA, which makes me question every other spec they've put in there. So I know that those assays are very temperamental assays. It's called a Lal assay. It requires horseshoe crab blood. It's a very complicated assay that basically clots when endotoxins are around. So those probably need to be scrutinized very heavily. If whenever you see plasmid DNA coming through in a contamination event like this, the first question people should have is, all right, go double check the LPS numbers, the endotoxins. Right. If they're elevated, we've got a serious problem.
Right. Yeah, exactly. This is very important for people to know. So from a we need to check this point of view, that has a big green check mark beside it for everybody. I also, like you mentioned a few things that people might not be, the terminologies they might not be familiar with in terms of the plasmid. So we have a gene which encodes the mRNA. We have an origin of replication. We have a promoter. We have some resistance genes for kanamycin and da 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 da. So I'm interested in this SV40 promoter thing and what the implications of it being there are. So yeah. I know I'm jumping around a little bit.
No, that's fine. That's actually an important topic. A lot of people zero in on that because SV40 has a horrible history in the vaccine industry.
Right, now, exactly.
To be clear, we don't have SV40, the whole virus. We right. just have the promoter. However, that promoter is known to be a nuclear localization signal, which is a concern. Particularly, there's one that has a 72 base pair insertion. That's a repeat that makes the SV40 promoter much more aggressive and also drives the sequence into the nucleus. That is present in the Pfizer vial. I have not seen that in the Moderna vial, but one of the Pfizer vials had two vectors in it. It had one with and without the 72 base pair change in the SV40. Both of them have SV40 promoters. But one vial was interesting in that it had two different vectors in it, one with this insertion and one without it.
That's wild.
Yeah, that one's, I don't understand that. They're from the same lot. So why do they have two vectors in one vial and only one in the other?
I mean, my science brain tells me that, and the argumentative part of my brain tells me that there's a reason for everything, right? It's, you know, maybe it was an accident. I don't think so. If one of them has this nuclear location signal and the other one doesn't, then it seems to me that maybe it was put there. I don't know. Maybe I'm putting too much meaning into it for a reason. But you know, the part of the spike construct also has this NLS, this thing that traffics it to the nucleus. So there's at least two points of interest that we can talk about in terms of locating to the nucleus, which is also something we should, you know, explain to people why that's bad. But it's and also, like, do you have any idea why there are two and one's missing the NLS and the other one doesn't? Do you have any idea, like, from a genomics point of view, like from a design point of view, from...
I can only guess that maybe they have one vector for Omicron and one for Wuhan. I've got to dig into that more because then it should exist in both vials in the same lot. And that was what was bizarre about it. So I don't know if this could have you know, spontaneously occurred by growing these things. That's something I've got to look into. But there's a lot of published literature on this exact mutation being leveraged in the lab to do this. So this is not an accident. Like this is designed, someone knew that this is an important mutation. Let's make this exact mutation so that we get a different result. And in terms of nuclear localization, you're right. I've seen some sequence in the 3' UTR that's a sirloin sequence. It's a little bit it's unclear whether that's fully going to drive it to the nucleus, but there's an amino acid sequence in the furin cleavage site that once it's a protein, it may in fact lead to localization. Why we care about localization in the case of these vectors is the moment you have DNA getting localized to the nucleus, you have to start worrying about genome integration. There's I'm sure you guys had some topics of discussion on this with everyone studying line one, and that line one could get expressed in some cell lines and convert the RNA into DNA and how that increases your likelihood of integration. Well, if they're injecting this much DNA, you don't need line one at all. You can get enough integration off of these vectors alone. And if the vectors have things that localize in the nucleus, then your odds have just gone up tremendously that there could be genome integration going on with this. Now, we don't have evidence for that today. It worries me more now that I've seen this data than it did based on looking at the Whitehead paper and looking at the Marcus Alden's paper.
Yeah. The thing that concerns me is, I mean, and it should concern everyone, is that what you're finding now wasn't, I mean, maybe it was found before they injected 6 billion people and they just, you know, it wasn't something that they wanted to let people know because people would be like, I'm not sure about the safety of these. I mean, my point is all of this should have been done and made transparent to the public. If this is about public health, before 6 billion people got injected, because if there's even a remote possibility of problems like integration into the genome, biodistribution into the ovaries, et cetera, all of these things that we were really mocked for even asking questions about, for like being closed down, for raising concerns about, for even invoking the precautionary principle at all. I mean, it's invoked. If there's a possibility of integration, like, you know, the line one story is that it's helping with the reverse transcription and then integration may occur. But what you're saying is that we don't even need that step anymore. We already have the entire, you know, bowl full of all the ingredients that we need, prime, ready for the oven of integration. So can you explain like the implications of what that means?
Yeah, so I think you raised an important point with how much was known early on. One thing you'll notice in the EMA document is that Pfizer had next generation sequencing data, which they wouldn't share with the EMA or didn't share. I don't know if they were refused, but it's noted that they have it and it's not disclosed. I suspect that's because they don't want people digging through and finding what we found.
Right.
Similarly, another group published, now these are on the bivalent vaccines. We don't yet know if this exists in the monovalents. We're sequencing those currently, but someone else had sequenced the monovalent vaccines, Andy Fire's lab out of Stanford, and they put the information up on GitHub, but they didn't put the raw reads public so that people could go, you know, sifting through to find the rare contaminants. They just put a consensus sequence up saying, we think this is what the majority of the sequence claims to be. And sequencing, that's not a good practice. You really should put all the raw reads public. This is why we have a short read archive in NCBI so that people can comb through them and find contaminants. It's been very productive in the COVID world where people have dug through other people's sequencing data and found, like, you know, rare strains of SARS floating in the wrong data sets. It's very forensic if you put the reads public like we did. So anyway, we have to revisit those older data sets and see if we can get those reads public. But we also need to sequence many more of these vials to understand how frequently is this occurring, how much does this vary lot to lot, because just in one lot that we looked at in Pfizer, it varied. So I'm assuming other people who try to replicate this work are going to get slightly different results as well. But that alone should bring a question about what is the regulatory oversight on this? If you can select any two vials off the shelf and get different expression vectors, that means they're changing the manufacturing on the fly. There's no one watching this, and that should scare everybody, because if you change the plasmid that's in here, you are literally like ripping the engine out of the Ferrari and replacing it with a different one without anyone looking. All right, that's a major, major change in manufacturing of any type of nucleic acid.
Yeah, and if you own a Ferrari, you know how you love your Ferrari. Do you really want it replaced with a Toyota engine? Not that I have anything against Toyotas, but seriously, I mean, you know, it's a great analogy and I think everybody can relate to that. Wow, yeah, it's just crazy. I love what you found. Okay, so I'm trying to get into the head of the people and like what questions they'd want to ask. So I'm still going back to like, okay, but what does that mean if there's double-stranded DNA contamination? What does it mean if there are kanamycin, you know, resistance genes in the plasmids? Like, could that affect your own gut microbiome? And if it could, how is it going to manifest? And Yeah, I'll stop there. Like, because I think a lot of people are wondering about that. Like, is it?
Yeah, so it's one thing just to caveat on the data is we know there's DNA there that we can sequence. We don't know what percent of the DNA is circular and what is how much of it's linear and how broken up it is. Still trying to resolve that. But we have taken some of this DNA and got it to transform E. coli and survive on a kanamycin plate. And that implies some small portion of it are in fact circular. And that goes to your point, what happens if one of these circular pieces of DNA gets into a patient and finds a microbe inside of a patient? Will it transform that patient and will that bacteria start being kanamycin resistant? Those are all good questions. They're speculative, but at the moment, we would assume, yes, that if there's plasmids that are being injected, plasmids get absorbed by bacteria with just simple 37 degree temperature, which is the temperature of your gut. They can absorb them, and if they confer any selective advantage, then they're going to replicate and become the dominant species in your microbiome. Now, that might require the patient to be on antibiotics for that to happen, for there to be a selective advantage. Otherwise, plasmid being in the E. coli may not confer any benefit, so the E. coli may just toss it out. But there are patients out there that are on antibiotics, so that is not something that should be out of the question. Sometimes they're used in treating SARS, so antibiotic use is quite common. So the concern is if these plasmids are present and they're getting into your microbiome isn't just in your gut. Your body has probably a 3-to-1 ratio of microbes to human cells amongst your body. And those could be absorbing these plasmids and we could be spreading antibiotic resistance throughout the billions of people that have actually been injected with this. Now, there's a couple steps there you have to have a high number of plasmids. We don't know exactly what percent those are. It has to get into a patient that's probably on antibiotics. So there's kind of two rare events there that have to occur. So maybe that's not very likely. But the next question people ask is, will those bacteria then make spike protein permanently?
And, right.
That's a more complicated question to answer. But the going thinking is they'll probably make the spike RNA. But they probably don't have the right tools. The ribosomes don't know how to read that RNA because they're bacterial ribosomes, and they don't understand the capitalization of the letter, if you will, in the RNA. There's a particular sequence in mammals that tells the cell when to start reading and translating. It's called a Kozak consensus sequence, and that is in fact in the spike protein mRNA that's in this plasmid. So the bacteria are going to make this RNA probably and not know how to translate it. However, bacteria are frequently absorbed by mammalian cells in a process called bactofection. So when your cells attack bacteria, they kind of eat them and engulf them and pop them open. And then all the RNA that's in there that the bacteria has made can then go to your mammalian ribosomes and maybe make some spike protein. This is not something that we should just disregard because the Kozak consensus sequence isn't going to do anything in bacteria. The real concern is that we've got an amplifiable piece of DNA that can replicate in bacteria. Your body's loaded with bacteria. It's going to start replicating this DNA once it gets inside of them. And we don't know what's going to happen after that. It could make RNA. It could get absorbed into mammalian cells. It could be killed and just completely gotten rid of. But the DNA shouldn't be there to begin with. We have to start monitoring how much of this DNA is actually lot to lot, and what is its length? Is it circular, and how much of it can we tolerate? I think before we keep administering these things, because this was an unknown contaminant that was not part of the informed consent, and it kind of changes our understanding of the risks involved in using these things, particularly considering the pandemic's over, and there's not a whole lot of risk reward gain for these vaccines anymore.
Yeah, 100%. Wow, so mind-blowing. All right, I'm trying to get into the mindset of the viewers. What do they want to know? Absolutely. First of all, I just want to restate for the record that I don't think a single one more shot should be administered until a whole bunch of things are done. And contamination issue questions need to be answered. You've said lot to lot a couple of times, and I get a lot of questions about lot variability because, you know, there's this thing in VAERS where some people have noted a higher preponderance of, say, severe adverse events in the context of certain lots. So it's something that I'm constantly monitoring, let's say, but not just from the point of view of VAERS. But the thing about it is, you know, I always try and step back and say, First of all, how much of this did they know? How much of this could they have anticipated? Because these aren't dummies. I mean, the people who are developing the technology and the research, they know all of this, these potential risks, I would assume. Like they know about how the plasmids work and the transfections and all of this stuff. They know about this. They know about the potential risks of introducing circular DNAs, as a contaminant into the human body. It's okay. Maybe it's two rare events have to occur in order for something disastrous to happen. But what if they do? I mean, we literally cannot, in my opinion, we cannot anticipate the outcome of what we've done in a realistic way. We just literally have to wait to see what happens to people. Which is, I think, why the pharmacovigilance databases are so important right now, and why I can't understand, or that I do understand, that they're being ignored. Wow. Is there any difference between, I'm trying to think of the best question to ask about the variability, if I should ask, why not? Is there a difference between the impact? Let's just say we have the worst case scenario. Is there a difference between whether you give these shots from a microbiome point of view, say in a child versus an adult? Is that something you can comment on?
That's a really good question. I hadn't thought through that, but that might be a good question for Sabine, because I think she has noted that there's different bifidobacteria in children than adults, and so there could certainly be a different impact there. Not to mention they may have a different tolerance for the level of circulating double-stranded DNA that they can tolerate. And another contaminant that we're looking a little bit more closely at. The other thing the EMA and the FDA look at is double-stranded RNA, because that also
Right.
the immune system. And when we did do RNA sequencing on this, there's a mechanism you can use in sequencing where you kind of count the number of reads you get that are from one strand versus the other strand. And usually RNA should all be on one strand because it's a sense strand that gets expressed. And so right as the T7, you come into the T7 promoter, you used to see predominantly sense strand sequencing occurring. We don't see that with their products. We see it pick up at the T7 promoter, which is expected, but then you get a mixture of sense and antisense sequencing after that, which implies there's probably some double-stranded RNA contamination as well. And I'm not impressed with the data that they had in the EMA document on how they're measuring double-stranded RNA contamination. They're using some ELISA method, which is ridiculous. It should be done with sequencing to monitor this stuff. So it's possible that there's two forms of contamination here, and we really are just dipping our toe into the second one. And I don't know how to predict what that's going to do clinically in adult versus children. It's a very important question, considering the benefit that children may get from this is nothing. I mean, they're not
Yeah,
COVID.
100%. So, from my understanding, if there's double-stranded RNA contamination, this can act as an adjuvant, right?
Well, be careful. I think in the vaccine world, there's this crime that goes on where every contaminant they stumble upon, they call an adjuvant. So I
Right.
kind of expected some of that language,
So let's talk about that.
Without a doubt, that's what they're going to do, is they're going to say, oh, well, that's great. It stimulates type 1 interferon response. It's an
That's what
adjuvant.
I read. But that's not good, right?
No. I mean, there can be too much of an adjuvant, and you can trigger too much of an immune response. In theory, for immunology is generally an amplifier. You want to put the least amount of antigen so that you can remember it, so your body can amplify the effect later. If you go in like a ton of bricks on your immune system, you're not doing yourself any favors. So you want to give the smallest dose possible so your body recognizes it, knows how to amplify the response later. That's what the whole adaptive immune response is about. So this concept of hunting for really high spike protein levels and getting really huge responses is basically going to desensitize your immune system. I don't think it's a valid approach that more is better for adjuvants.
Oh, I agree with you 100% on that. Really interesting to know, though. I hadn't realized that they were hiding behind the guise that the double-stranded RNA contamination is a good thing because it acts as an adjuvant. makes it more potent. You know, when people hear that, they think, oh, that's good. But it's like, no, it's not good. just circling back to Sabine, this is Dr. Sabine Hazan. She's a gastroenterologist, for people who don't know. I have yet to talk to her, but I will one day. And she has discovered something really interesting. I'm going to try and summarize. You probably know more than I do. She looked at the bifidus colonies. I think it's bifido. I don't know the actual name, but it's a certain type of species of bacteria, which is a high colonizer in the gut of humans. And it's important. It's very important. And for those of you who don't know, from an immunological point of view, the gut is extraordinarily important. Like, most of your immune system is in the malt, the gut of your immune system. So a lot of the action that goes on there. So I wouldn't call it a fragile environment, but I'd call it an environment that needs to maintain a certain amount of balance between all of the players involved, and bacteria are very important in this mix. So she found that that people who had been, now I don't know how many doses and I don't know what product, I'm just summarizing the loose translation of what she found, that people who were injected didn't have any bifidus. And more interestingly, injected moms who were breastfeeding had babies who had zero colonies as well. And so again, it's not that we know the implications of this. All we can say is that this really warrants investigation, because we don't know exactly what the implications of a zero bifidum baby is. It could be very bad for that baby. It could be very bad in terms of setting the stage for a healthy, functioning immune system for the rest of the life of that baby. So these are the things that are really important that we need to think hard about. And again, I would recommend no mother to breastfeed after, like, shortly after getting injected.
There's too much evidence of mRNA showing up in the breast milk. And yes. It's usually getting expressed through extracellular vesicles, which can survive the GI, the baby, and transfect the esophagus. So that's not a wise move. And to your point, we don't have good information on the biodistribution of these LMPs. They're all animal studies, and the animal studies show they're getting to the gut. So this is not something that we understand where it's going and what it's doing in humans. We're just guessing off of animal models. And the transparency hasn't been very, very forthcoming on that front. So there's a lot of unknowns there and what this is doing with the microbiome. And now that we know we're delivering DNA that has antibiotic resistance genes and origins of replication that can replicate these things in bacteria, we've got to step back and ask, what does this mean? What's the impact of having that DNA around? Can we get rid of it? Does this have consequences for longevity of what we're thinking is mRNA in the blood or in the serum or the breast milk? We have a lot of studies showing that, but that could be PCR picking up actual DNA, not RNA.
Right. Right. So in terms of we've already mentioned anaphylaxis, but in terms of anticipated, because I most people are wondering, I get a lot of emails from people saying, I got two or three shots, I'm terrified, I don't know what to do, I hear all this stuff about contamination and this and that, and they're really worried about what might be happening to them, what might have happened to them, or what might happen. And I I'm not an MD, so I can't really give them medical advice, but I usually just ask the simple question, do you feel good? And most people say yes. And I'm like, well, you're fine in all likelihood. And don't stress out, because that's an immune system killer. But from your point of view, because you're doing something that is way above my head, could you offer anything on, like, the subject matter of what people, like, even questions they might ask their doctor, if their doctor is open to having a conversation? Like, what can we look for symptom wise, for example? Is that something you could
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't have good, really good background to describe what to look for clinically and what this means clinically. I just know from a manufacturing QC standpoint, this makes me question everything in all their documents, because they're not just missing the mark a little. They're missing the mark by orders of magnitude, which means no one is at the helm. No one is watching this, which means every other metric they have, from endotoxin to double-stranded RNA, should be questioned. If it's this bad, and so I should back up. The sequencing we did cost like under $100. All right. So for a $100 billion product line to not be doing this on every lot means they have a massive hall pass. They don't care. And that means if they're not doing the cheap $100 sequencing, which gives you a tremendous amount of information, they're not doing the $5 and $10 tests either that are giving them, minimal information about LPS content or other contaminants. So the mere fact that they have some NGS data as reported in the EMA that isn't public, that tells me that they know they should do this, they can do this, and that they might in fact internally be doing it on every lot, but not sharing it. But it's such a tremendous amount of information you get for such little money that if they're not using this to guide the amount of contaminants they have, then I don't believe they're doing any other testing. Because this is the first thing I would do on checking these lots is check that the actual sequence is what you think it is, and if there's any contaminants in it, because it's the cheapest form of biological information you can get your hands on with the state of DNA sequencing. So it makes me question the whole gamut, and I don't know where to guide people like clinically what they can do about this, other than we now have tools that can detect this contaminant in people's serum, in people's blood, and maybe in breast milk. The PCR tools we developed to detect this in the vaccine vials could readily be turned around and used on the blood supply, let's say.
Yep.
And help answer some questions of how long does this stuff stick around in the blood, and is it predictive of long vax or long COVID or any of these other artifacts that people are having in terms of sequelae.
Yeah, that's wicked. It's a wicked answer, because I think it not only it applies to many facets of what we're seeing. Like people, I think people they're okay with getting tested, especially if they have a question about how long is this stuff going to stay in my blood. Because I think more people are starting to hear from their family or their neighbors that maybe there's a problem with these things sticking around a bit longer than they should, for example, and so. Most people are like, I want to go to the doctor and find out. Like they're okay with getting tested. So that's really important, because that's how people, and I think, you know, the people is where the power is, can really help. Get your doctors, get your community leaders, get whoever to start doing this kind of thing, to promote testing, to get the ball rolling on answering some of these very important questions. That's really, really important.
I just want to add that I know testing has left a dirty taste in a lot of people's mouth, because it was used to lock a lot of people down, perhaps indiscriminately during the pandemic, but all of that equipment is now idle. And I would advise people turn the tables on them and use that equipment to track the contaminations in the vaccines and point out all the problems, that the mess that they just created. If they don't like CT calls, well, they're going to have to live with them now on their vaccine.
Yeah, 100%. I read a fantastic article by Martin Neal on the testing, the pandemic of testing, but we won't get into that now. We have about 10 minutes, and I really want to help people to understand that you, because of what you've done, now people can replicate and reproduce your work. And tell everyone about that, because that's really important, because we're all about transparency and reproducibility.
Yes. Yeah, so that's actually the key part of science. It's not peer review. Everyone hears about peer review, but peer review is meant to get us closer to reproducibility. And so now we could go through peer review. It'll take 6 months to 12 months, and during that time frame, too many people get hurt. The better thing to do is to distill any hypothesis you have into something anyone else can replicate very, very quickly and cheaply. That way, others can get on with the reproduction of this. So that's what we've attempted to do on our Substack, is to spell out all the methods that we have used to do this, And we've even put all the primers public. We put all the sequencing we've done public. So anyone else can go in there and build primers if they don't like ours, to build them and go test for this. The reason this is important is now that we have these tools made, you can take just a microliter of the vaccine. For those who aren't familiar with those metrics, you use about 300 microliters or 500 microliters, depending on its Pfizer or Moderna. That's the injection volume. So for 1/300th of the dose, you can check the DNA contamination levels of these things. So this should be very easy for those to replicate. The other thing we did very recently is we spent time getting rid of the DNA prep. So there isn't this expensive centrifugation chloroform step to isolate the DNA and RNA out of the vaccine. You can just take a microliter of it and boil it and put it into PCR. So the only thing you need is a thermocycler to check this. This should enable labs all over the world to quickly falsify, verify, or improve upon the work that we've done and post their results. And the last part's really important, improve, because we are a small team with no funding for this, that we're doing this on weekends and nights because we're just passionate about it. And we stumbled into this, and now we're kind of pregnant with a problem that we had to put public. So we want others to add to this because they'll find things that we're missing. But having this done on PCR with a boil prep is, I think, really critical because it allows reproduction for this for under $1,000. I think once you have the PCR test and the components for it, you can actually reproduce it for like under 10 bucks. But you're gonna have to order some PCR primers and probes, and those have some, you know, install fees of ordering them in bulk, but then you can use them across hundreds and hundreds of reactions. So we're now at a stage where you can monitor this thing for probably under $10 to $20 a pop to understand how much DNA is floating around in the vaccines. And all of it's open source. Anyone can download the primers, scrutinize them, change them, modify them, and improve. That's the whole point of putting this thing on public and fairly real time.
You mean it's not a trade secret?
No, it's not. You can go on that site and pull down all the primers you want. Now, we do have I happen to have a company that makes kits for doing viroid testing in the cannabis space, known as medicinal genomics. So we do sell a lot of these parts that can get you off the ground running faster, but you're not necessarily wedded to them because you can get them from anybody else as well. These are like PCR enzymes and master mix kits and tools for doing these boil preps. But those aren't exclusive to us. We don't have patents on them. They're tools that we're just good at providing to our customers. We tend to sell them in 200 reactions at a time, which might be overkill for some labs currently. But once you get going on doing a lot of testing, you'll want to buy in bulk. It'll save you money. So we can get folks running on this very quickly and very cheaply. And our team has some experience in putting this stuff on robotic automation hardware. So if you need to scale it can be done pretty readily. But first things first, let's get in the cart before the horse. The first thing is let's get other people to replicate this. I know of a couple labs that have already contacted me saying they have found vector in the monovalent vaccines. I don't know how much yet. And that is their kind of publication to share. They've just shared with us that it's in fact, they've replicated our work. And they're now going through the process of trying to line up how much and if dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. So hopefully that data will come public shortly, and we ourselves are also sequencing some lots that were sent to us that are monovalent, and we also have the Janssen one in here as well. So we'll hopefully have information on a variety of the other providers shortly.
Well, I just can't thank you enough. I mean, this is the exciting, beautiful, lovely part about this 3-year nightmare. I mean, it's the culmination of nerds who just really are interested and who are continuing to do what they've always done in the same way. We're not paid, we're not incentivized, we're literally just doing what we've always done, and we're finding each other because it's just, I don't know, the coalescence of ideas creates a much a closer version of the truth, I suppose. I don't know how to say it. We're not hiding anything. We're not saying no, I want the credit. It's more about no, I want the answers that I'm dying to know to have in my lap so that I can A, know for myself and also communicate to other people. So we're out of time. Again, I never understand how an hour flies by. And I have to do a little shout out about what's coming up next. But Kevin, I just want to say a huge thanks for coming on and because I don't know. Did I go black?
Yeah, you did freeze up there for a little bit, but I think I got the message. You guys are onto a new thing. Thank you for having me. And, you know, you can follow my work at Substack, Repetitional Genomics. Sorry for this outrageous noise here. Next time we'll get a soundproof room.
Sponsored by Pfizer. All right, my dear. Have a lovely day, and we'll talk right, later. Cheers. So stay tuned, everybody, for the Friday roundtable later today to hear the shocking new autism prevalence rates released just yesterday by the CDC. The CHD team is going to expose the agency's willful blindness, and that is the right terminology, to seek the true causes of autism, allowing the crisis to escalate. You won't want to miss it. So again, everybody, thanks for tuning in. I hope this was informative. Go read Anandamide's Substack, find out what anandamide is, because that's a fascinating story. There's a movie called The Scientist, which you should watch. And my Substack is jessicar.substack.com. And I apologize for not putting anything up. I'm in transition. I'm in geographical flux right now. So don't worry, I'm going to start pounding out articles soon. So lots of love, lots of health. Tell everyone that what you just heard, and see you next month.